From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're thankful for that. We're thankful for each of you and your contributions. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, sundown on Sunday marks the start of the Jewish observance of Rosh Hashanah. Monday is the Christian feast of the Holy Cross. Thursday, Hindus celebrate Ganesh Chaturthi, honoring the god of prosperity, prudence, and success. And Friday brings the start of the 8-day Jain festival of Parushana, Parva. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Thank you all so much. I love you all so very much.
This was not the right job for her.
She'd probably be able to win the governor's seat right now.
Let Kim go. But if you have to put someone in jail, I volunteer to go.
Well, jail seems a little extreme.
Wasn't going to do it. Just wasn't going to let the Tempest in a Teapot Kentucky County Clerk controversy take up any more time on this show, because it's become painfully obvious that one misguided woman making $80,000 a year in an elected office has become the fundraising cornerstone for the likes of Family Research Council, Liberty Council, and various other anti-gay hate groups peddling a dishonest and ultimately dead-end vision of religious freedom. But an article by Sarah Posner, the only religion question reporters and debate moderators should ask presidential candidates, Kim Davis edition, offers a model for using this moment to at least get some clarity on who still believes in the U.S. Constitution and who doesn't. Sarah will be back with us on this week's State of Belief.
So what is Rosh Hashanah about? It is a time to remember that the path forward is always possible, and no matter what is going on in the world right now, a better tomorrow is ours to create and to celebrate the ability to create it.
Sundown Sunday brings the start of Rosh Hashanah, the celebration of the Jewish New Year. Some holidays offer nothing more than a brief distraction from thinking about the troubled times in which we live. Rabbi Brad Hirschfield, president of CLAL, says his tradition's New Year's teachings can inform and uplift us, even in the face of conflicts. And he'll be back with us to share those thoughts. But first,
I think we'll have a measurable impact, but I'm not exactly sure what it is. What I have to say is we just went on the bus because we wanted to educate people about what was happening here in D.C., but we got educated. And then it was this dynamic, amazing event that keeps going. And for me, that's the Holy Spirit.
A few months ago, Sister Simone Campbell, Executive Director of NETWORK, a national Catholic social justice lobby, was on this show telling us that she didn't know the next time the headline making nuns on the bus would ride again. Well, now she knows. In fact, the sisters are already rolling across the country on a 13-day tour leading up to Pope Francis's historic U.S. visit. The trip kicked off on Thursday in St. Louis. We taped a conversation with Sister Simone literally minutes before the bus rolled out of St. Louis. Simone Campbell, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Oh, great to be with you, Weldon.
This time, the theme is Bridge the Divides, Transform Politics. It's a long ride to get that done.
What we know is Pope Francis is coming to the U.S., and his challenge globally has been to build an economy of inclusion, to end the exploitation of our people and our earth. And so what we realized was that in advance of his visit, what we need to do is to, one, spread that message, but then gather stories around the country about the divides that exist in our society so that we can transform our politics. We won't have an economy of inclusion unless we've got a politics of inclusion. So we're starting out on the road again, crazy women that we are, to really bring the message that we the people can make a difference. We can do this together, but we've got to make change. We've got to make change.
My sense was, Simone, that the invitation for the Pope to speak to Congress came from some people that thought they might just be getting affirmation for their agenda. I think his agenda, obviously, is much more profound and much larger than any partisan political agenda. How do you think that address in Congress is going to go?
Well, I think it's going to be a challenge to all of us because, you know, while, you know, I'd like to say, oh, the Pope's really with me and my agenda, the fact is the Pope transcends that agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And we're starting here in St. Louis because it's become an icon of some of the racial struggles in our time.
Right.
Well, what I've realized is that I am a white woman. I walk through the world with white skin that gives me privilege that I am unaware of. And what Pope Francis is challenging us all to is to realize the privilege in a variety of ways that we each have and make sure everyone has that same privilege. It's a huge challenge for us. So while I'd like to say, well, I'm sure the Pope's going to be in favor of making permanent the earned income tax credit, his message is so much deeper than that.
Sure.
He's calling for love of everyone, that there should not be this violence in our world. We've got to transform it if we're going to save it. That's what we've got to do.
Tell me about the itinerary leading up to the 22nd.
Well, we're starting here in St. Louis, headed to Kansas City, on to Topeka, down into Arkansas, Tennessee, Indiana, Ohio, West Virginia, and then ending up in D.C. If folks want to see our actual route, look for a picture on the bus because our route's on the bus. But also you can look at our website, nunsonthebus.org, and you can see where we're going. And hopefully listeners will be able to join us at some of our events. There's RSVP requests there, so we'd love to have you come. You can come even if you don't RSVP. We just want to have a sense of how many folks are coming.
So what are you going to be saying? What's the message you want to amplify with this latest Nuns on the Bus tour?
Well, that we have too many divides in our nation. Some of them are partisan. Some of them are based on race. Some of them are economic. We just heard from a transit worker here how hard transportation is in St. Louis, and I never realized that that reinforces the divide. Folks without cars can't get from one side of the city to the other. That's a huge problem. So what we want to do is lift up the divide, but then in the evening what we're going to do at our town halls is to not only lift up the divides, but lift up innovative ways that we can make a difference, that we can bridge those divides. And so we're going to hear from local folks about what's happening and share our best ideas. You know, our communities across the country, I say, are like petri dishes.
Mm-hmm.
Creative folks are trying new things to make a difference. We want to hear the best of the ideas and share them as we go, sort of Johnny Appleseed style.
Yeah. Johnny Appleseed, that's good, because I was going to ask you if you had an Apostle Paul complex, but Johnny Appleseed's a...
I hope I don't get shipwrecked.
Is better. Are you going to take a look at the racial divide?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's why we started here in St. Louis. We just had our opening rally in. And we started in the shadow of the arch, which is the gateway to the West, which is the gateway to hope, but also looking right at the courthouse where the Dred Scott decision was made, which reinforced slavery and was the sin of our past. And so we've got a huge divide racially, and that image is kind of the anchor image for this movement.
Mm-hmm.
We want to promote the hope of the gateway and the divide of this judgment and prejudice that's the sin of our past. What I've realized is that one of the big reasons I joined my religious community is because of civil rights. I'm a child of the 60s.
Hmm.
But I haven't really talked about it. So I'm trying to be both vulnerable, talking about when I was a kid in elementary school, remembering seeing kids being escorted by the armed military into school in Little Rock, Arkansas, so they could integrate the school.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, it was the first time I realized my white privilege, that I got to go to school anyplace without an armed guard.
You've talked to us before about the hopes that you have for Pope Francis and his role both in the church and in the world, what are you hoping his trip to the United States will give us?
Well, I'm hoping that this trip will let us all know that love is at the heart of this, that all are welcome, no one can be left out of our care, including our earth, and that what we, the people, the best of who we are, is when everyone has a chance. And I think Pope Francis's challenge to us will be that we all need to make change. It's not that I can have the luxury of demanding, well, if you were just like me, we'd be fine. Mm-hmm. No, we all need to change and be open to working together to create the future. I think that's what he's about.
Simone, I know that we're talking today just minutes before you board that bus again. Can I ask you what you feel right now about to begin another of these trips? What is going on in your heart right now as well as in your head?
Well, I'll just share with you that this morning as the sisters, there's nine of us, as we gathered for prayer, you know, I open the scriptures sometimes after a period of quiet, and what came was 2 Timothy, where Paul says to Timothy, well, you know, preach the gospel, whether it's welcomed or unwelcomed, mm-hmm. and to have courage to continue in that mission and ministry. And so that's really at the heart of it. We're just trying to do what we're called to do, to be women of love, walking towards people who welcome us or people who don't, but knowing it's the work of the Spirit. And always my Pentecost prayer is, may the people hear what they need. It's not so much that the apostles at Pentecost got the capacity to speak all these languages. It was people heard what they needed and they were comforted.
Sister Simone Campbell is the tireless executive director of NETWORK, a national Catholic social justice lobby. We spoke on Thursday just before the sisters set off on their latest Nuns on the Bus tour. Sister Simone is the author of the book, A Nun on the Bus, How All of Us Can Create Hope, Change, and Community, which not only tells the story of this amazing campaign, but offers a blueprint for activating the spirit of the sisters in your own life and engagement with the issues you care about. Simone, I have you always on my mind, and I hope you have a safe and successful journey. And I really want to thank you. I know this is a very busy day, and you're so kind to take a few moments and speak with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, such an honor to be with you. You do great, great work yourself, Weldon. Together we make a difference. Thank you so much.
The Rowan County, Kentucky clerk who defied the United States Supreme Court and found herself jailed for not just refusing to issue marriage licenses, but interfered in other clerks doing so, has already gotten so much attention that I had no interest in talking about her again this week. But then I read a compelling Religion Dispatches column by journalist Sarah Posner, headlined, "The Only Religious Question Reporters and Debate Moderators Should Ask Presidential Candidates, Kim Davis Edition," and bang, I changed my mind. And so I'm very happy that Sarah Posner is able to be back with us again on State of Belief Radio. Sarah, welcome back.
Thank you, Welton.
So what is that religion question that we should be asking presidential candidates?
It's the only religion question that we should be asking them, and that is, do you believe that there are circumstances when the government should step aside or that a law should be superseded because of somebody's religion? And if so, what are those circumstances?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a question about what is your religious belief, Mr. or Ms. presidential candidate, but it's really about, do you believe that folks like Kim Davis should be allowed to let God's law or God's authority supersede that of our nation's highest court?
How do you come down to saying this is central?
This is central because I think that it's a central question in the moment that we are living in now. Mm-hmm. Because I think that we've long had discussions about separation of church and state and free exercise. And this is not really a question of should our laws be imbued with religious belief? Like, mm-hmm. should the government fund sectarian parochial schools? Or should publicly funded schools be able to require students to recite the Lord's Prayer? Mm-hmm. This is a separate question, really, that really goes to a candidate's governing philosophy, which is, here we have the law of the land, which some of the Republican presidential candidates have conceded. But you have a bunch of the presidential candidates who refuse to concede that Obergefell v. Hodges is the law of the land. Mm-hmm. They think that the Supreme Court was not authorized to issue that decision, and mm-hmm. therefore that someone like Kim Davis can say, no, I'm sorry, God's authority supersedes that. Mm-hmm. And I think that in this particular moment that we're living in, that is really the central, crucial religion question that particularly the Republican presidential candidates should be asked.
Sarah, have you heard any candidates besides Mike Huckabee answer this question or at least address the issue in a way that would clarify where they are on it?
As I say in the piece, Huckabee has been the most upfront about this, the most upfront about claiming that the Supreme Court doesn't have the authority to issue this opinion and bind court clerks across the country to issue marriage licenses to gay and lesbian couples. I think that the other candidates have skirted around the issue by framing it as an issue of Kim Davis's religious freedom, mm-hmm. that requiring her to issue the marriage licenses infringes on her religious freedom. I think Huckabee has honestly framed the issue as a question of whose authority are we supposed to obey here, the Supreme Court's or God's. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that he framed it in that way, in the same way that Kim Davis did, by the way, is very revealing. And I think that the other candidates should be asked that question and be asked to state where they stand on that, because mm-hmm. I think that was something that was very revealing about the way Huckabee thinks about these things.
As a somewhat a theologian, let me just put an asterisk by what you said and say that Huckabee is asking about whether we should pay attention most to our government or to God and God's will as understood by Mike Huckabee.
Right, yes. I mean, what he's saying is God's will or God's authority is not universally accepted by other Christians as what God's will and God's authority is.
Right.
Which makes it additionally problematic, but right.
Isn't it amazing that we're now 180 degrees from John F. Kennedy's promise not to let his faith get into the way of his presidential responsibilities?
I've been pondering this question for the past several days, that does this incident with Huckabee and the way he mobilized people to go to that rally for mm-hmm. Kim Davis and the way he put himself out front for that, does that demonstrate that he's serious about his presidential candidacy or that he's not serious about his presidential candidacy? Mm. Is it a moment of desperation for him to seize this incident as a way of drawing attention to himself because his candidacy is sort of floundering? Mm-hmm. And I don't think that his candidacy is floundering only because of the Donald Trump phenomenon. I think that if Donald Trump weren't in the race, and we would probably have a Bush or a Rubio or a Walker in the lead, I don't think that Trump is the one pushing Huckabee out of the picture. Mm-hmm. And so I almost wonder whether this is a sign that Huckabee isn't taking his own candidacy that seriously, mm-hmm. and it's just sort of a last-ditch effort to save his public persona.
That's a really interesting, I'm glad you pondered that. That's a really interesting thought. This really is all about politics. Huckabee wouldn't let Ted Cruz on the stage at his Kim Davis rally last week. On a related note, I noticed that the non-historian David Barton just got hired to lead Ted Cruz's super PAC. Sarah, if this were a TV show, it would be a terrific hit comedy, wouldn't it? But it's not.
Yes. I think that the David Barton thing is clearly intended to shape a message on behalf of Cruz by his super PAC for the Christian right. Mm-hmm. Although for many people, even on the Christian right, Barton has been discredited by, you know, the historical errors in his own writing.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about Huckabee's aides not letting Ted Cruz into the photo op, in a follow-up piece I wrote about Davis, I said, after all, the Bible does say that those polling in the single digits shall reap the glory of exploitative publicity stuff.
That's good.
You know, it's just ridiculous. I mean, if they really cared about Kim Davis, would Mike Huckabee care whether Ted Cruz got into the photo op with him or not? It's very, very revealing. It's very obviously about politics, but they're trying to make it to be about conscience and religion and dedication to the cause.
Sarah, am I going too far if I draw a line from the giddiness with which some conservatives seem to greet the defiance of someone like Kim Davis to the Planned Parenthood videos, to government shutdowns, to Donald Trump's outbursts, to things like the Bundy standoff? It's almost as if there's this permanent, and I have to say childish, sense of oppression and outrage. And anything that disrupts the 21st century order of things is celebrated with no thought to the consequences. Do you see that? And if so, how big a problem is it that leading political candidates seem to embrace this impulse?
Well, I mean, I think that even Donald Trump's candidacy, which has not rested on religious claims at all, thrives on the creation of chaos or the promotion of the belief that America as we know it and love it is under siege. In Trump's case, it's under siege by immigrants. In Huckabee's case, it's under siege by secularists and gay people and whoever else, right? But yeah, it's kind of the modus operandi for the modern Republican Party to create this sense that chaos is being made out of the American dream and that it's the fault of quote-unquote outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in this election cycle in particular, that ideology is being brought to the fore more because there is no front runner who's trying to be the reasonable person. In 2008, you had John McCain trying to be the reasonable person. Well, of course, until he picked Sarah Palin as his running mate, and she brought this whole chaos idea to the race then. But in 2012, you had Mitt Romney trying to be the reasonable person. But in 2016 or 2015, what we have is Donald Trump as the front runner. He's not trying to be the reasonable person. His next competitor is Ben Carson. He's also not trying to be the reasonable person, although his demeanor is much more sort of sedate. And so I think that you could easily be fooled into thinking that maybe he's the reasonable one. But, you know, this is a person who has said that, you know, Obamacare is the worst thing to happen to America since slavery.
Yeah.
Yes, it's very problematic. And I think that the Republican Party is actually very worried about it in this election cycle because they do not have that person this time. They do not have the John McCain or Mitt Romney to emerge from the pack and say, you know, I'm the reasonable one. Obviously, that's supposed to be perhaps Jeb Bush or maybe Marco Rubio or maybe John Kasich, but none of them are getting any traction.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, Sarah, that you mentioned Trump and Carson, because it looks like now we've got a battle going on between the two of them, with Carson challenging Trump's faith and Trump saying, who is he to question my faith?
Right.
Where is that going?
Well, I mean, I think that Carson sees his own support among evangelicals rising. And so he's going to take a little dig at Trump and say, you know, like, here's a guy who really doesn't take his faith very seriously. Isn't that pretty obvious?
Uh-huh.
And then Trump hits back at Carson and says, who is he to question my faith? And I thought what was really interesting about that was that in those statements that Trump made in response, he revealed that he doesn't know very much about that evangelical base that he thinks loves him so much. He says, I don't think he's a great religious figure, Trump said.
Uh-huh.
If you look at his faith, you're not going to make it very far. I think that that statement is going to come back to haunt Trump. Mm-hmm. Ben Carson is a very popular figure in the religious right. His book, Gifted Hands, which I think first came out in the 1990s, mm-hmm. it's sort of a pablum memoir about how faith got him through the difficult challenges in his life. From a kid raised by a single mom and was very, very poor growing up and didn't have any advantages in life to becoming this great neurosurgeon and the role that faith played in that. And this is a book that a lot of evangelicals have read that has been in Christian bookstores for two decades, something that's very familiar to evangelicals. And for Trump to say that, I think reveals a lot about how little he knows about his faith.
So could this be the first really major bump in the road for Trump?
I think that that's going to depend on how seriously the evangelicals who really like Ben Carson because of Gifted Hands and just because of his whole history as a great doctor and neurosurgeon who isn't afraid to talk publicly about his faith, I think it's going to depend on how seriously those evangelicals take Ben Carson as a presidential mm-hmm. candidate. Mm-hmm. They might not like it that Trump dissed him in this mm-hmm. way. But on the other hand, they might see Trump as more of a no-holds-barred kind of leader that they're looking for right now.
Right.
If you read what some evangelical thought leaders are saying about Trump, I think that for the evangelicals who do like him, they like that he's not afraid to take on mm-hmm. the people that they don't like
right.
Barack Obama.
Yeah. You know, I saw Rick Perry in his rally last week where he tried to stir up the crowd by shouting, "Onward, Christian soldiers." What do you make of that? Is that more desperation?
Oh, that is clearly desperation. Rick Perry is possibly the most desperate of the presidential candidates, maybe him and Bobby Jindal. Rick Perry's presidential candidacy isn't going anywhere, and I think he's just grasping at straws right now.
The second GOP debate is next week on CNN.
Yes.
Tell our listeners what you're looking for in that.
Well, I'm really going to be looking for questions about Planned Parenthood, questions about Kim Davis, and I would love to see Jake Tapper ask the candidates the question that I've proposed, but I'm not going to hold my breath. But I would like to see some questions on this. How do they frame this religious liberty question, and how far do they think that protections of religious liberty should go?
Mm-hmm.
Do they think that a court clerk's belief that God's authority trumps the Supreme Court
mm-hmm.
should be allowed to get away with that? But, you know, there are a lot of other issues that I would love to see them asked about, not just the bickering among them,
mm-hmm.
but questions about, you know, the refugee crisis, questions about college affordability. There are a lot of questions out there, climate change, that it would be good to see the Republican candidates get down to some policy
mm-hmm.
answers.
So we're back to that all-important question of whether a candidate's faith trumps their constitutional obligations. I really do wish that question would get asked, although I'm not going to be holding my breath regarding that. Investigative journalist Sarah Posner writes widely about religion and politics for The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Atlantic, The Nation, and Salon, among others. We'll link to her Religion Dispatches article, "The Only Religion Question Reporters and Debate Moderators Should Ask Presidential Candidates," the Kim Davis edition, at stateofbelief.com. Sarah is the author of the book, God's Prophets, Profits, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. That one has stayed current, by the way. Sarah, it's just a conversation today. It just reminds me of how much I enjoy talking with you, and I'm so glad that you had the time to come on today and enlighten us with your insights. Thank you for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
It's always my pleasure, Welton. Thank you.
As we struggle to deal with so many big issues in the troubled world around us, few religious observances are more timely in the lessons they offer than is the Jewish New Year's celebration of Rosh Hashanah, which begins on Sunday night. For some thoughts on these lessons, I'm very pleased to be able to welcome my friend Rabbi Brad Hirschfeld, president of CLOUL, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. Brad, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It is so good to be with you. It's always good to be with you, Elton. Thank you for having me on.
You know, I've been thinking a lot lately about religious holidays, holy days, special celebrations, and it occurs to me there is so much wisdom in the celebrations of most all religions that there's something to learn. And, of course, I know we're coming upon a time of Jewish celebrations and observances, and it's always great to have you on, but to have you on at this particular time is helpful. Man, we've got turmoil all around us, and I want to ask you to help us understand that this religious observance that you're going into in the Jewish tradition can offer us the way of wisdom perspective that we badly need at a time like this. First of all, do you agree with me about the potential?
I absolutely agree with you about the potential. I couldn't be me. I couldn't be a person who at least aspires to be one of a person of faith if I didn't. So absolutely, you are completely right. I don't think it's only true about my tradition, by the way. I believe the reason all of our faith traditions have endured, I get it, they're not perfect, they're not lived perfectly because we, the transmitters, are not perfect, but they have endured because they have given people tools to navigate the biggest questions we face as human beings, whatever faith we follow.
Yeah, so well said. You know, the issues that we're facing right now, and particularly the issues that are swirling around in Jewish minds all over the world, are unfortunately pitting sister against sister and brother against brother, whether on political grounds or around very real existential fears for the future. So, Brad, how can we find some common ground with each other, even if we can't resolve some of these fundamental differences? And I think we both agree it is imperative that we find that.
I think you're absolutely right. And I'll even go further. I think we have to tap into our respective traditions and observances, not only to find the common ground, but how to live in a shared world, even when we stand on different ground within that world. And I think they're both vitally important. I think the first one is always preferable, but I know that real difference will always be there. In fact, I kind of celebrate that, because that difference between traditions and peoples and views, I think, is actually a mirror of the larger infinite one in whose image we're all created. So I want them both. I want common ground where we can, and I want common decency even when we can't stand on common ground. As it happens, the coming run of holidays, and it's really three holidays right now in the liturgical season for the Jewish people. Rosh Hashanah, the new year, which begins Sunday night and observe Monday and Tuesday. And then the following Tuesday night into throughout Wednesday, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And then 4 days after that, the Feast of Tabernacles or Booths, known in Hebrew as Sukkot. And I think each of them has at least one component, one tool that we can use to find some of the common ground we need and the common decency we must have, even when common ground eludes us. So I'll go real quick, and you'll jump in as you want. Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the Jewish New Year, actually does not celebrate the birth of the Jewish people, which is an amazing thing. Most faiths and most ethnicities, their New Year begins the beginning of them, of that people. Already 2,000 years ago, the rabbinic sages at the time of Jesus made a decision. The Jewish New Year would not celebrate the birth of the Jews as a nation. That happens at Passover in the Exodus from Egypt. In fact, what Jews around the world will be celebrating starting Sunday night is the birth of humankind. Over and over again, we say, today is the birthday of the world. And so the first thing people will have to figure out is how in their own tradition can they remind themselves that whatever their particularities are, and I love all the particularities of my faith, but whatever our particularities are, we are part of a bigger community than the community of our faith, than the community of our nation, than the community of our flag. We are part of a human community.
And I don't want to slow you down because I want you to take us through all three of those, but I have to stop and ask, let's just take the controversy that's been going on over Iran and how we're going to handle all of that and the divisions among people in the Jewish community as well as in other communities. Relate that, if you will, that issue, that controversy, to what you've just said, which is a beautiful expectation and expression of interest, not in just the Jewish nation, but in all nations.
So I'll give you a very specific example for this fight, which has surfaced. I don't think it created. I think it surfaced a number of tensions within the Jewish community around Israel and this deal. And all cards on the table, I am more opposed than not to the deal. Though having said that, I hope all my fears are unfounded and wrong, and that ultimately as this deal goes through, which it will, I'm proved wrong, and those who support it are proved right. But the thing that's connected to Rosh Hashanah, that larger narrative we're a part of, here's what's so fascinating to me. It turns out that among American Jews, both those who favor the deal, which is the majority of Jews who were asked, by a slight amount, and those who oppose the deal, which is a slightly less than 50% number, in both camps, more than 95% say they believe their position, pro or con, is actually for the good of the modern state of Israel. Mm-hmm. In other words, we can have the fights we need to have politically. We can differ on policy, but don't confuse a policy difference with a fundamental lack of commitment to the larger thing you care about. So it turns out the Jews who are pro and Jews who are con, the deal, both care about Israel. So don't denigrate someone by saying you don't care about X because you don't practice it my way, whether that's the politics of the Iran deal or how you worship as a Jew or how you worship or live any other tradition, because the same thing, you can be pro or con different communities and their practices as long as you remember you're part of that larger human community.
Yom Kippur.
Yom Kippur is a day of repentance. It's very simple and won't be surprising to you at all. From God's perspective, there is actually no sin too big to be forgiven, which is a profoundly hopeful message because it means however much we screw up as individuals, as communities, and as nations, there is always a reset button if we really want it.
You know, Brad, I always have found Yom Kippur to be important to me as well as to the Jewish tradition. The one thing I want to ask you about that is, I know it's a day of repentance and of cleansing. Is it correct for me to understand that that is an emphasis on that day that doesn't end in a punctiliar fashion, but tells us how we've got to live all the time, not just that day?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in fact, I would argue that it's really a very happy day, contrary to what a lot of rabbis teach, because that kind of forgiveness is actually assured. And then what it says is live the other 364 days of the year working toward being the person you most want to be. And then know by the time Yom Kippur rolls around next year on that 365th day, any place that you fell short, if you sincerely examine it and commit to do better, you can be forgiven and start yet again. In fact, I would say that, you know, most people know the central ritual of the day is fasting, no eating, no drinking. And that's true. It's a biggie. But I often think that the holiest moment of the day isn't the 24-plus hours of fasting. It's when you gather with the people you love at the end of the fast and break bread, or in my tradition, raise a glass wine, vodka from the freezer, single malt whiskey, the drink of your choice, and look into the eyes of the people gathered at that table and use the oldest Jewish toast we have, L'chaim, to life, and to affirm life in the year ahead. The whole reason to have those 24, 25 hours of penance and fasting isn't to feel bad. It is literally to clean out so you can live into the year ahead well.
Well, now that makes a lot of sense for me then to moving to the booths.
Yeah, because in the end, that's the story of the journey. And we know from the Hebrew Bible narrative that these are the booths that we imagine the ancient Israelites, having left Egypt on their way to Canaan, to the promised land, they dwelled in. Now, the amazing thing is about those booths, because they can be built out of wood or plastic, and they can be lattice or solid. You can do almost anything you want architecturally. The key feature is the roof. And the roof has really only two qualifications. It has to provide more shade than sun, and it has to be permeable enough that if it rains, a little water can come in. Now imagine that is the model of our shelter. We need enough protection so that by and large we feel safe. But we should never be so safe as to wall ourselves off from what's going on in the rest of the world.
Hmm. Oh boy, that's really good. Brad, if I or anyone else listening wanted to not so much pray for the Jewish community, but pray with the Jewish community, what would you advise me to pray for?
Oh, boy. Well, first of all, I think what I'd do is tell everyone, listen to Reverend Gaddy about the shift from praying for people to praying with people. Because if we could make that shift to be willing to pray with each other, as opposed to for each other, because in my experience, when you pray for someone, what all of us tend to really be doing is wishing they were like us. And so our prayers are kind of exercises in narcissism. When we pray with people, almost whatever we pray is that we realize, actually, that ancient promise, which is part of the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur liturgy, actually, those words from Isaiah, my house will be a house of prayer for all people. That we will stand shoulder to shoulder with the integrity of our discrete traditions, but knowing that with all those differences, sometimes in their complexity, sometimes in their beauty, sometimes in their annoyance, we do stand together. And that is what it means to pray with each other, not for each other. I guess what I'd ask, let us all pray from whatever liturgy we use, to be able to have hearts and minds that know how to pray with each other and not just for each other.
Hmm. I want, before we get off today, to ask you about the Rabbis Without Borders program. I know it's highlighted on the CLOW website, and I think it's something our listeners should know about. Say just a word or two about that and CLOW itself.
Sure. CLOW itself. Imagine an organization really just committed to two simple propositions. There should be room in the Jewish community for anyone who wants a place at the table, regardless of dogma, doctrine, or belief. And if there isn't currently a place at the table, our job is to build a bigger table. Number two, the Jewish actually isn't just for Jews or about being Jewish. Jewish is a public good that should be available to as many people as easily as possible, not for them to become Jewish, but to use a 3,000-year-old tradition to make their lives more meaningful and ethical and make the world a better place for all. That's CLOW. Rabbis Without Borders is simply the rabbinic network of about 150 rabbis from across the country and across the denominational spectrum who are committed to those values, who understand that the people in front of them are more precious than whatever ideology is inside of them, and that their mission as rabbis, yes, to serve a synagogue or an organization or their denomination, all well and good, but that ultimately it is to use the tradition they love best to serve the people before them, whoever they are and wherever they are.
Rabbi Brad Hirschfield is president of CLOW, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership in New York City. He's the author of, I love the title of this book, You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism, a book that only grows in relevance with every passing year since it was first published in 2008. What a wonderful way, Brad, for us to end this week's show of State of Belief. Thank you for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio. And my hope for you is a very meaningful and joyful series of holy days.
Thank you. It is a pleasure and an honor to be with you and to learn from you. All the best. Well,
that's all the time we have for this week's show. I hope you've heard something that made you think, something that made you feel a little more optimistic, hopefully something that made you smile too. If you know someone who you think should benefit from hearing what you've just heard, then I encourage you to tell that person or those people about it. We'd like to have them as listeners. We make it really easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter, and of course at stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you'll find information on supporting this show financially. Donations from listeners like you have been an important part of making State of Belief possible for almost 10 years now. Now, you know, during that time, there have been moments when the future was very shaky for us, and you've always come through. I want to thank you if you've been among the generous supporters that have helped us so much. And I want to urge you to consider joining others in keeping this show on the air. The website, one more time, is stateofbelief.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our free weekly podcasts and find links mentioned during the show, as well as an archive of past shows, extended interviews, and transcripts. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.